Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 3, Chapter 4. Hiranyakashipu terrorizes the universe. We're just going to read the chapter introduction so we get an overview of what the chapter is all about. This chapter fully describes how Hiranyakashipu obtained power from Lord Brahma and misused it by harassing all the living entities within this universe. By severe austerities, Hiranyakashipu satisfied Lord Brahma and obtained the benedictions he desired. After he received these benedictions, his body, which had been almost entirely consumed, was revived with full beauty and a luster like gold. Nonetheless, he continued to be envious of Lord Vishnu, being unable to forget Lord Vishnu's having killed his brother. Hiranyakashipu conquered everyone in the 10 directions and the 3 worlds and brought all living entities, both demigods and asuras, under his control. Becoming the master of all places, including the residents of Indra, whom he had driven out, he began enjoying life in great luxury and thus became mad. All the demigods but Lord Vishnu, Lord Brahma, and Lord Shiva came under his control and began serving him. But despite all his material power, he was dissatisfied because he was always puffed up, proud of transgressing the Vedic regulations. All the brahmanas were dissatisfied with him, and they cursed him with determination. Eventually, all the living entities within the universe, represented by the demigods and sages, prayed to the Supreme Lord for relief from Hiranyakashipu's rule. Lord Vishnu informed the demigods that they and the other living entities would be saved from the fearful conditions created by Hiranyakashipu. Since Hiranyakashipu was the oppressor of all the demigods, the followers of the Vedas, the cows and the brahmanas, and religious saintly persons, and since he was envious of the Supreme Lord, he would naturally be killed very soon. Hiranyakashipu's last exploit would be to torment his own son, Prahlad, who was a Mahabhagavat, an exalted Vaishnava. Then his life would end. The demigods were thus reassured by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Everyone was satisfied, knowing that the miseries inflicted upon them by Hiranyakashipu would come to an end. Finally, Narada describes the characteristics of Prahlad Maharaj, the son of Hiranyakashipu, describes how his father envied his own qualified son. In this way, the chapter ends. Text 1. Shri Narada Muni said, Evam, thus, Rita solicited Shatadriti, Lord Brahma, Hiranyakashipu of Hiranyakashipu. Hata, then, Pradat delivered. Tat, his, tapasa, by the difficult austerities, prita, being pleased, varam, benedictions, tasya, unto Hiranyakashipu, sudurlabhan, very rarely obtained. Narada, translation, Narada continued, Lord Brahma was very much satisfied by Hiranyakashipu's austerities, which were difficult to perform. Therefore, when solicited for benedictions, he indeed granted them, although they were rarely to be achieved. Shri Brahma Vacha Tate Me Durlabha Pumsam Yan Vrinishe Varan Mama Tatapi Vitaram Yangam Yanga Varan Yadyapi Durlaban. Lord Brahma said, O Hiranyakashipu, these benedictions for which you have asked me are difficult to obtain for most men. Nonetheless, O my son, I shall grant you them, although they are generally not available. Purport. Material benedictions are not always exactly worthy of being called benedictions. If one possesses more and more, a benediction itself may become a curse. For just as achieving material opulence in this material world requires great strength and endeavor, maintaining it also requires great endeavor. Lord Brahma informed Hiranyakashipu that although he was ready to offer him whatever he had asked, the result of the benedictions would be very difficult for Hiranyakashipu to maintain. Nonetheless, since Brahma had promised, he wanted to grant all the benedictions he asked. The word Durlaban indicates that one should not take benedictions one cannot enjoy peacefully. One time, Trivika Maharaj was with Srila Prabhupada at Tittenhurst was the residence of John Lennon. You know who John Lennon is? No one knows who John Lennon is? Okay. And John Lennon was with his wife, Oko. Is that her name? Yoko. She's still alive?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
So Yoko, and Tittenhurst was quite an opulent place. Trivika Maharaj mentioned to Prabhupada that isn't it wonderful, something about it, whether wonderful or not, that John Lennon, he's worth at least 300 million pounds. And at that time, a pound was much heavier than it is now. Brother said, well, what is the use of all his money? He doesn't know how to utilize it. Just like if one is a poverty-stricken devotee, then they're actually in a more fortunate position materially than even someone who has great amounts of wealth. Because people have great amounts of wealth, although theoretically they should be able to enjoy more sense gratification than a poverty-stricken person, but often it's seen that they're actually not able to enjoy as much sense gratification even as a poor person. For instance, eating, unless you know how to eat, then, or what to eat, then eating, having money will not help your eating. If you think eating or opulent eating is to eat some dead animal that died in some World War II and they preserved, or eating some fish from a poor eggs from a poor fish, or the wing of some bird, that money you're spending is simply not helping you enjoy, it's actually making you suffer more. On the other hand, if you have no money and you're eating rice, dal, chapati, sabji, gulab jamun, sandesh, samosas, pizza offered to Krishna, ice cream, obviously you're enjoying much more than the poor billionaire who doesn't know how to eat. Not only, of course, the devotees sometimes don't know how to eat either. They know what to eat, but they don't know how to eat. Because often people, they eat and they don't chew their food. So although they're so anxious to get taste from the food, because they don't eat it, they don't chew it, therefore they don't even know what they're chewing, what they're eating. And they just hope when that tomato falls down into the stomach, somehow or another, the stomach has teeth and it will be able to chew it. They can't understand why it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. Or they assume it should. But if you have nice prasadam and you chew it and you relish it and remember Krishna, then one is in a much more opulent position than any materialist. And sleeping, unless one's mind is peaceful, one cannot sleep very peacefully. One will simply remember all the horrible things that went on during the day. Now, if you have nothing, you have nothing to worry about. As soon as you get something, as soon as you assume you have something, then the only thing you do is worry about it. If you have one car, so many worries. Then you have to worry about paying for the car and repairing the car, putting oil into the car, putting gas into the car, cleaning the car, making sure that you don't lock your keys in the car, making sure that no one else steals your car, that the wind, the rain, the snow, the sleet, it doesn't destroy your car, you don't crash your car, no one else crashes your car. There's so many things to worry about. As I said before, the more you identify yourself with the car, the more you're in trouble. It's called aham car. I am the car. But we're not the car. We're actually the so-called proprietor of the car, but it's not our car. But it produces in our minds, or theoretically, can produce so much anxiety over the car. On the other hand, if you have one car, you're in anxiety. If you have two cars, you're twice the anxiety. So what is the value? How many cars do you need to go from here downtown? You don't need any car. You can just walk down and do Harinam on the way, if it was normal times. But anyhow, to get somewhere, you may want a car, but two cars, one for each foot, won't do you very much good. But it'll put you twice as much anxiety, make you work twice as hard, or use up twice as much pious activity, whatever you did in the past, in order to get the car. And what to speak of having more opulence than that? Theoretically, you think you own so many things, and therefore you're attached, and so much anxiety over everything. And at the time of death, you have to get the reactions. Or if you don't utilize these things in Krishna's service, then you get a reaction for everything that you have. Prabhupada was walking by a house one time in Switzerland. Has anyone ever been to Switzerland? They're quite meticulous. I think it's dramatic consciousness. Quite meticulous about everything. And they walk by this house. Every blade of grass is exactly in the right place. Every leaf on the tree was exactly where it was supposed to be. The house was immaculate. The roof was nicely and newly painted. Completely, everything was, every panel on the house was painted and shiny, and even the birds were singing in harmony. So Prabhupada said, oh, this person is very unfortunate. Because he's so attached to his house that he's assured that if he wasn't pious, if he did anything sinful in his lifetime, then in his next lifetime he'd have to take birth, maybe as a mouse in the house. So much concentration on the house, and the result will be that one will live in the house in the next lifetime, but not necessarily as a human being. So what is the value of maintaining your house if what's going to be what's going to happen is you become a mouse in the house. Of course, I'm sure they had a nice cat. Prabhupada gives the example in one of his books that one man was a very miserly man. He collected a lot of money and he had many sons. But because of his sinful activities, in the next lifetime, he became a cobbler. Shoemaker. So he went to his former house to sell his shoes to his former sons, and they took the shoes and they beat him with it. Such was the gratitude. He worked so hard, and his sons were enjoying the results of his work, and he wound up getting beaten for it. So that's material existence. Sleeping, if we're not peaceful, if we're too attached to the material energy, what's happening here, we can't sleep peacefully. And then mating, of course, people don't even know how to mate nowadays. They think mating is simply sex life, and that's it. They have no idea how to actually psychologically, mentally, intellectually blend with anyone. They're not even aware of who they are, or what they're doing. What to speak of what anyone else is doing. Nor do they care what anyone else is doing. They only care what they're doing. Therefore, there's no question of relationships even. It's always me, me, me. Everyone serve me. Everyone's taking a picture. Me, me, look at me. But the only one who's looking is you. And even they see your picture, they're just thinking, yeah, how can I exploit this person? Very nice mentality. You're putting your picture on Facebook so everyone can be envious of you. See how happy I am? Don't you wish you were as happy as I am? And everyone's looking at you thinking, yeah, how can I make this person miserable as I am? That's the benedictions you get from everyone. We bless you to go to hell. You have our admiration. So people don't know how to mate. They don't know how to relate to each other. They think mating is just, somehow or another, chew people, and then when you finish chewing them, and you got, and there's no more taste, you just spit them out and find someone else to chew. That's called love. I love chewing on apples, I love chewing on pears, and I love chewing on you too. And when you're done, we spit you out with the pit. And as far as defense, people have no defense. Because they've used up all their intelligence, they use up their aura, they use up everything. They're defenseless. A mouse comes, they're screaming, oh, don't kill me, please. I'll give you anything. Here's some cheese. Go away. They're lucky if they can look both ways when they cross the street. That's the only exercise they have during the day, is they look both ways before they cross the street. That's their yoga exercise for the day. So their immune system is down. They have no idea psychologically how to protect themselves from the environment. So many different advertisements, people, so much noise and people screaming, and so they're psychologically, physically, mentally, intellectually, they're defenseless. And they're walking around thinking, I know everything. And they don't know anything. They don't even know how to live in the material world. And yet, they've been puffed up by their so-called education that they don't know anything. Etam drishtim avashtavya nashtatmano nabudhya pravanyuka karmana shaye jagato hita. Following such conclusions, lost to themselves, the demoniac create horrible, unbeneficial works meant to destroy the world. So if one is not trying to fall in love with Krishna, if one is not trying to understand one's relationship with everyone and everything in relation to Krishna, then one will simply be engaged in activities which are causing destruction for oneself and others in the name of so-called progress. So Rani Kashyapu wanted so many benedictions, but the result is that they didn't save him from death. And not only that, but he committed so many offenses against a pure devotee that he became greatly degraded in his next lifetime. He went from Rani Kashyapu to Ravana, which is a really big degradation. He went from first class demon to Varya Dainam to fifth class demon because of all his offenses. But he didn't become a devotee. And in the next lifetime, he went from a fifth class demon to a 100th class demon. He probably was not even qualified anymore as a demon. He became a Shishupal. So one should be careful. Well, one should try to become Krishna conscious, and whatever benedictions Krishna gives, not to be attached to them, to understand that these things are meant simply to be utilized in Krishna's service, and we don't need more than we have. As a matter of fact, sometimes we have too much, and it would be better off if we didn't have so much, so we don't have to worry about so many things. What we should worry about is whether or not we're Krishna conscious enough. Whether or not we're putting ourselves working with a certain mentality that not only will remember Krishna, but will actually be in harmony with Krishna, feel the same the way Krishna is feeling, feel the same way Srimati Radharani is feeling. Unless we can feel like that, them, how can we experience who they are? Because they're living in a world of transcendental emotions and feelings. They're not just doing things. Krishna's not just getting up in the morning, taking the cows and the coward boys out so they can get enough milk and set up a dairy somewhere. No, it's simply love. Their whole pastime is love and service and devotion. That's all that's going on there. They're not getting more cows. They're not breeding cows in the spiritual world and then coming here and trying to sell the milk, make a little extra profit. That's not why Krishna comes here. Krishna comes to spread the same type of consciousness that's in the spiritual world. And if we adopt that consciousness, then we'll also be in the spiritual world. And if we work and we don't adopt that consciousness, then we'll maybe be doing the right activity, but if we're doing the wrong consciousness, we'll still be in the material world. Maybe in a better place in the material world, but still it'll be the material world. So Hiranyakashipu got so many benedictions, we might be envious. If someone came and said, you can have all mystic powers, you can have a body that even Indra couldn't kill, you know, you'd probably be happy. But he was more miserable than any of us are. How many of us are thinking, you know, where's the liquor? I got to get drunk. I feel so miserable. We may feel miserable, but most of us won't turn to go to the liquor store. But Hiranyakashipu got all the benedictions we can't even imagine. And yet he was miserable. So what was the value of it? We gave you everything and you became completely depressed, couldn't talk to anyone. Every time anyone looked at you, you yelled at them. What would be good of your opulence? So that was Hiranyakashipu. So we shouldn't be envious of him, thinking, well, maybe if I practice fasting on Ekadasi, one day I can get to his stage and Brahma will come and give me these benedictions too. Of course I'll utilize them in Krishna's service, but mostly. Still we should understand it doesn't do you any good. But what does someone good is, as Queen Kunti said, Vipadakshantu takshasvat tat tat prapyushubha. Vishan mahagne Vishan Mahagne, Vanavana Krishita, that you've saved us from the poisoned cake, from the fire in the forest. Vishan Mahagne Purushada Darshanad, from the man-eater who came to eat us. So many problems they had. Asab Sabaya, Vanavana Krishita, then they were put into Draupadi to try to be disrobed, which, by the way, we heard that was the beginning of Kali Yuga, when Draupadi was being disrobed in the presence of these elderly gentlemen. And at the same time, they were thrown into the forest and exiled into the forest for 14 years. So many problems. Vipadakshanti takshasva tatra tatra jagat jago jagat guru. Bhavato darshanam yasyat apuna bhavadarshanam. But she was praying, can I see these calamities again and again so we can see you again and again? Because by seeing you, there's no more, I will no longer be seeing repeated birth and death. So the greatest benediction is to do what we're supposed to do to please Krishna, and that way remember Krishna. That's the greatest benediction possible in this mature world. Otherwise, Janmaishvarya Shruta Shibir Edamanak Madatpuman Naivahatya Vadatum Vai Twam Akinchana Gochara. What people are hankering for, Janma, taking birth in a so-called civilized country. Civilized country nowadays means some other so-called civilized country is not coming overhead with airplanes trying to bomb you back to the Stone Age and steal everything you have in the name of liberating you, making you humble. So Janma means taking birth in a relatively peaceful country, which is, it's hard to find a relatively peaceful country nowadays. Aishvarya, wealth. Nowadays wealth means some plastic or paper money or money in the bank. But some kind of wealth, Aishvarya. Wealth in the Vedic culture was land and cows. Now they don't understand the value of cows especially. They think cows are actually destroying the globe because they're passing gas. So they're so envious they want to kill the cows because they're passing gas. Well, people also pass gas. Maybe they should kill the people too. They are doing that too. But that's a different thing. Shruta, so-called learning, the ability to prove that black is white and white is black makes you a scholar nowadays. If you can, whatever learned person, whatever learned knowledge you get, whatever learning you get from learned persons, your whole objective is simply to defeat them, to come up with something better. They may have perfect knowledge, but you have to figure out some way of finding how it's imperfect. Like Ramachandra Khan, searching day and night, not Ramachandra Khan, Ramachandra Puri, meditating on Lord Chaitanya, day and night, trying to figure out what's wrong with him. That's called knowledge. And Shribi, personal influence and beauty. Attract people so that you can influence them and exploit them to your maximum desire. So this is what people are mad after in the material existence. How to look like you're 20 when you're 90, and how to look like you're 30 when you're 5. People are just after some kind of influence in the material world. Wealth, power, influence. But Kunkundi says that we're already in the Bali concept of life, which makes us intoxicated. We're intoxicated by the modes of material nature. And we're just like an intoxicated person. He's imagining that he's flying in the sky, or he's swimming like a fish underneath the ocean. But he's just intoxicating. It's all imagination. So similarly, we're intoxicated by the material energy, imagining ourselves to be the doer of so many activities, the enjoyer of so many things. But when someone who's intoxicated, they take more intoxication, then they become completely crazy. And they'll do all kinds of crazy things. So those who are hankering after these material benedictions, the result is that they become mad, completely crazy. As we can see nowadays, some cold comes along like it always does, because we're leaders are more or less mad. Therefore, their reaction is to create a situation where everyone suffers even more than they normally would have if everything just, you let things go on. So many people may die from some disease, but by the arrangements, they make sure many more people die from their arrangement to protect us from some disease. They make an arrangement so many more people will die from their protection and would have died from the disease. So this is called madness. And because people are mad, and the leaders are mad, andayatan dhirapagiyamanaste piksha tantra urudamibara, because they're blind, and the leaders are blind, therefore they simply wind up in more difficulty. So we should understand what the real naishamatis tavada rukramangrim spriksha inarta bhagavan inarta mayesam pararuje vishekam is kinshananam na navrita yadva. We should understand what is the real benediction is to get the dust of the lotus feet of a pure devotee like Srila Prabhupada and take it seriously, follow his instructions, try to develop the same mentality he has, and try to help the suffering humanity. I was hearing a tape today of Prabhupada. He was explaining he was in Bombay. It must have been 74, because I remember I was in India at that time. We were having the first temple president's reunion in 74, and we first went to Mayapur, and then we went to Bombay, and then we went to Vrindavan by train. And I think it was when we were in Vrindavan that Prabhupada asked the devotees there, the temple presidents, if any of them came, we were asked if we came from one of those countries that were related to India. At that time they had some kind of alliance between India and Canada and Australia, Commonwealth countries.
An alliance.
What's that?
An alliance. An alliance.
Commonwealth it was called. There was economically, they were all, you know, it's almost like the European Union now. So they had the we could only get 1 month visas at that time, but they could stay and extend it 3 months or more in India. So they wanted to go to Bombay to protest against the police chiefs declaring that our Harinam was a nuisance. The devotees were chanting Hare Krishna in the street, and the police chief were arresting the devotees, declaring that the chanting in the street was a nuisance. So Prabhupada wanted the devotees to go there and protest. And at the same time, there were so many attacks in our temple. Besides that, it was all part of a scheme to get us out of Juhu temple. So Prabhupada said, what can we do? Everyone is attacking us. That no one's coming to our help, practically speaking. But we have to be tolerant. Karunika, what is it? Titikshava Karunika. Prabhupada went over those two. He was, I guess the verse was Titikshava Karunika Srida Sarvadehinam Ajata Shatva Shanta Srida Sarvadehinam. That, he said that a devotee has to be tolerant. So many harassments we're getting. But still we have to tolerate, like Prahlad had to tolerate. And at the same time, Karunika has to be merciful. That these people are all mad and crazy, that they don't know what they're doing, they don't know what the goal of life is, they don't know why they're suffering. So we have to be merciful and try to give them Krishna consciousness. Although these people in Bombay, he said, are all crazy, they don't want us here, but still out of mercy we're going to stay here and establish this temple. So that's the job of the devotee. If we want to get Krishna's mercy, we want to get out of the bodily concept of life into the spiritual concept of life, we have to become tolerant and merciful and not be so much attached to trying to get more than necessary in this material world for Krishna's service. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions? Comments?
Maharaj, how can we combine these ambitions of so-called material men who strive only for material things, but this ambition is there in Krishna consciousness? Like, this ambition can be disused in Krishna consciousness and not be material and make some...
Depends what ambition are you talking about. Your ambition is to get 108 gopis like Krishna. That would be difficult to dovetail in Krishna's service, unless you want to take 108 lives. What ambition are you referring to?
like career.
Career?
Create something with, I don't know. With
what kind of career? Krishna had a career. He was he's a coward boy.
Yeah.
He's quite good as a coward boy. He has a lot of practice. He has a career, and he's always getting better at it. Radharani has a career. She's a cook. So you can't have a career in Krishna service. So there's possibility. Now, if you want to get another kind of career, it's possible to utilize the Krishna service. If you want to become a lawyer, you can become a lawyer for Krishna. If you want to become so many careers, Arjuna was a warrior for Krishna. So it's possible. But it should be for Krishna, that's all. So many devotees have promised, I'm going to get rich. And after I get rich, then I'm going to give everything to the movement. And in the process of becoming rich, they became Krishna consciously poor, materially envious and greedy, and they didn't give anything to Krishna. So we have to be careful. And in the process of our so-called career, we don't get a career becoming a demon. Yes.
Hare Krishna. What was your, may I ask you, what was your impression in India in 1974? Was it your first?
As far as I remember, it was my first time. I can't remember if I went in 72 or 74, but anyhow, I think it was 74. What was my impression? We rented the first Boeing 747. It was because at that time, all the temple presidents came from America. And there was 100 of us, so somehow or another we arranged it so that we rented this Boeing 747, the first one to land in Calcutta. We got out of the airplane, and it was March, but it was still warm, so it was a lot better than from America. America was it was winter still. And I walked out in the air on the tarmac, and dozens and dozens of people just sitting around doing nothing. I said, why aren't these people doing something? I never was in a place where people just sat around and did nothing. And, it's a long story, my impression. Well, we drove to Mayapur, and Mayapur was a construction site. There was absolutely nothing there except for a half-finished building called the Lotus Building now. But there was, for that time I was there, we had practically no food, edible food. We had a lot of mosquitoes. And we had a lot of problems. The devotees didn't know what they were doing. I remember we were having kirtan. And someone there was no real temple room at that time, but they had where they have the dioramas now, that was the temple room, that little tiny place. And the devotees, somehow or another, they got this idea that if you bump into the devotees during kirtan, that was ecstasy. So you're in the kirtan, people are bumping into each other. It was just so strange. Anyhow, it was rather, I had to go through some cultural acclimatization. It was really a quite different experience. And then because the food was so strange, it was so weird. Not because the food in India is weird, but because no one knew how to cook properly for 100 devotees at that time. And so I was starving, practically speaking. I'll just give one story, as I've told before. All the temple presidents, they had to take turns cooking because they didn't bring anyone else. They just came themselves. So all these Indian chiefs didn't have any Indians. So all the chiefs had to cook. So I was asked to cook. But I had experience cooking because I was not only the temple president, but I also was cooking sometimes. And I had one of my services for a couple of years, as they said, was a cook. So I had some experience. So they told me, cook some peanuts. So they said, no problem, you know. Where is the ghee and how do I, you know, where? He said, no, we don't use ghee here. We use sand. I said, well, sand? That's all right, but where do you get the sand from? Because I had some idea, you know, the sand had to be, there was a certain kind of sand you had to use to cook the peanuts on. No, we just dig it up from behind the construction site. I said, well, that's, you can't do it. You know, if you do that, then how do you wash it off? You know, it all stick to the peanuts when you try and cook them. Oh, no, we do that all the time. Don't worry about it. So then I cooked, you know, 100 people, 100 devotees. There's a lot of peanuts, a lot of sand, too. A big wok and a lot of sand. It wasn't even filtered, the sand. So I said, well, how do I get this, how do these peanuts? Oh, you just, you know. You wash them off. You wash off the dirt. I said, well, that turns into mud. No, don't. We do it all the time. Just try it out. So I washed off the peanuts, and it was just, they were covered with mud. So I kept on washing them off. 2 hours later or 3 hours later, it was time for the offering. I said, well, they're full of sand. They're still, you know, this, you can't get it off. I said, no, don't worry about it. The devotees are hungry, they won't even notice. No, they offered the peanuts, and they served it out to the devotees. I wouldn't eat it. So I asked the devotees, I said, how are the peanuts? He said, well, they taste pretty good, but they're a little gritty for some reason. Gritty means they're, you know, it tastes like there's some sand on them. So that was my experience. I can tell other stories, but I didn't want to go back to India for a while. The next time I went back was a lot better. We were much more experienced. I went back a couple of years later. Anything else? Just as another thing is that I remember I was so hungry. We had to leave Mayapur. And I was so hungry because, you know, practically we weren't eating hardly anything. So I decided, and they told us, don't eat anything on the outside. But there was nothing on the inside to eat. So I went outside and bought some sweets. And I ate the sweets. They must have been made out of 90% parasites. And I got so sick, I couldn't believe it. The first time in my life I ever gotten sick like that. You know, I was just like, by the time I got to Vrindavan, was like, I couldn't hardly move. And unfortunately, for me, Jamuna Devi Dasi was cooking for all the devotees. Because I think she saw that everyone was practically dead, and she didn't want them to die in Vrindavan that time. So she was cooking, but I couldn't eat anything. I was just waiting to get back to America so I could introduce the parasites to the doctors there. They weren't pious enough to die in Mayapur. Yes.
It's interesting that when I read or hear about the 50s and the 60s, even 70s in India, Indians are accused of being fatalistic and passive. Whereas nowadays, there's so much hustle and bustle. They are really hustling. It's hard to find really somebody who's idle, actually. So what do you think happened that those days in the 50s, they were so, like, almost paralyzed?
Well, they didn't have television. As soon as they introduced television, then everything changed. And when Bollywood started to introduce another style of movies, and of course now they have the internet, so. But television was the first killer. You go to India, that you see, even they have these shacks made out of cardboard sticking out of the shack as an antenna. Oh, because people, that puts you in the mode of passion. You watch these movies and go on the internet, you'll be put into the mode of passion. Still, they hear from the sadhus, but the sadhus are mostly impersonalists. Impersonalism just fuels their passion, too. Okay, thank you very much. Grandharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.